All right, hello and welcome to episode number 34 of the At U2 podcast, where we talk all things U2, including album news, tour dates, important anniversaries among staff, and community discussions from the staff of At U2. I'm your host, Chris Enns, and once again, I am joined by Mr. Matt McGee. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
I am well, and Sherry Lawrence, you're out there, too.
Howdy, everybody. And by the way, I need to give a shout out to Tim Q, one of our loyal listeners who stopped me in a bank parking lot in my hometown to say how much he likes the podcast. I'm like, oh my God, you recognize me?
Nice.
He said, actually, it might have been the license plate that gave you away. So to Tim, thanks for listening.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. And, I was going to ask how he recognized you on the podcast, but okay.
Hey, she tweets out the selfie every time we record. And Tasula's back. Welcome back.
I am back. And I just like to say, if anybody ever approaches me in a parking lot, they're probably going to be the recipient of some of my self-defense training. God love you. But yeah, I know that's well intended, but yeah.
So just shout it from across the parking lot.
Just wave a nice
Tasula, I recognize you.
Tweet me that you're going to be away from the parking lot in a public place with a lot of people, and I will go meet you there.
Well, we have listeners all over the world. Apparently, I had a client, a friend of mine, who said he was talking to some YouTube fan or a fan. He found out it was a YouTube fan, and he was telling them about the podcast that they should listen. And they were like, "Oh, we already listened to the show somewhere in Niagara on the Lake or Niagara Falls. I forget which." So, if you happen to listen, hello from the At YouTube podcast. You have beautiful waterfalls nearby. It's been a few weeks since we recorded, so we apologize for the absence of At U2 audio in your ears, but we're back to hopefully fill them up with interesting discussions. Before we get going, I just wanted to quickly touch base, Sherry. You had a follow-up or a wrap-up, I guess, of the African Well Fund progress?
Oh, I sure do. They just promoted today that they absolutely exceeded their goal and raised, I think it was close to $9,800 for the Build a Well for Bono's birthday. So they've since closed that campaign out and thanked all of the supporters. And they'll let everybody know when his birthday card is done and sent. So well done. Thank you, everybody, for supporting such a worthy cause.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, you just jinx, you owe me a Coke.
My two oldest are in the midst of that phase of life, and I had to tell them, in my 39 years of living, I've never received a Coke from any jinx, you owe me a Coke.
You just don't live close enough to me. I always make good on it.
Oh, do you? Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll remember that in case. All right, let's move on to the inbox. Actually, Matt, did you have any follow-up? It's been a while since we talked, the U2 40, hashtag U2 40 event that went on where you live tweeted U2's performance at
Red Rocks. So fun, the Red Rocks thing.
Yeah, and I don't know, just thought I'd touch base because I don't know if the listeners have necessarily heard about it or saw it maybe, but I know we talked about it on the show, but that was before it actually happened, and just any follow-up from that.
We haven't done a podcast since then.
I don't think so.
Nope.
Slackers we are. Gosh, no. I thought it went well. People seemed to enjoy it, and I don't know. I had a lot of fun watching the show with everybody on Twitter, and I think we should do that kind of thing again.
Yeah, definitely. I think even just the live tweeting of the day of or whatever was fun. But even knowing that there's a whole bunch of people watching, I forget what I was doing that night, but I couldn't watch with people. But I was following along on Twitter, and just knowing there's a whole bunch of people sort of like pressing play now and watching the concert at the same time is kind of fun too. So
yeah, we'll do that again for sure.
Yeah, they have.
What was really fun was getting here. Other people's perspective of what they were seeing, because we were watching it simultaneously, that I had forgotten that I guess Bono's belt must have broken or something, but it was electrical tape that was holding his pants up for the show. Right. You know, it's those little details like that, that I'm like, wow, I totally forgot about that. And for Matt to post something about the director's commentary, I hadn't even noticed that there was a director's commentary on it. So I stayed up another 2 hours and watched it again, listening to the director's commentary. I need a life.
No, none of us need that.
Yeah. I just need an example of how to suggest a title in the chat room. So there we go. I need a life.
I need a life.
Which doesn't apply to any of us because we're all normal people recording podcasts about YouTube. There's nothing weird about that, obviously, because we're normal. Okay, moving on to the inbox. So folks who've sent in questions over the past 3 weeks, obviously, using the hashtag AskAtU2 on Twitter. One that's just a quick bit of follow-up from the last episode was from at TJU2. He or she said, listen to podcast 33, read kids and U2. I have two words for you all that you left out. Rock Band 4, because U2 has a couple songs in Rock Band. But unfortunately, Sherry, what's the... four words response you have?
Well, I have four words. No Rock Band for Wii U.
Yeah, so I think it's just PlayStation 4, has, so, Xbox One, whatever. So yeah, if you're not cutting edge, you don't get any U2 on your plastic guitars, I guess,
no.
Is the moral of the story. So we can start a fundraising campaign maybe or something for for Sherry to get.
Starter?
Yeah. All right, so moving along. At Tim Jahar asked or said, can you explain the fascination with Acrobat? I've talked to tons of U2 fans and can't figure out why it has such status here. So, Matt, do you have a response?
With Acrobat being played, wanting to play it live, right?
I'm assuming they mean. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's what Tim means. And can I explain that fascination? No, I cannot, because I don't share in that fascination. And I think, I'm not positive, I think we've talked about this on some previous podcast, but we know that not everybody listens to every podcast. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see the fascination with it. And I think if they ever play it live, it will kind of go over like Electrical Storm did, which means it'll last about two or three shows and they'll realize it doesn't sound good. So
I'm thinking it was.
But I know
eight.
I'm in the minority on that. That's like
no,
everybody.
You're not in the minority. Well, most of the people I know agree with us.
We are. Well, yeah, you feel the same way I do. But you know, that's all. Whenever we do the survey, that's always the one song that everybody wants them to play.
But here's the thing: it's because Acrobat is, I believe, the only track off of Achtung Baby that hasn't been performed live. So there is a small contingency of loyal fans out there who want to hear you two perform any song that they haven't performed live. And so Acrobat has the most momentum because it's such a popular album. And that will continue to snowball until it actually happens.
Until they play like half of it and the casual fans start crunching their nachos and everybody gets pissed because the people who really do appreciate it won't be able to enjoy it anyway.
Like your Blue Room.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's what happens, you know. Anyway.
Nice. Yeah. I like that.
It's true.
All right. At Lyron Hollick asks, I would really love for you guys to do episodes where you go through specific albums, shows, or any meaningful event, would you? And then the follow-up tweet from them actually was, just listen to the last episode. It's like you read my mind. So by way of introduction to what's coming up on the roundtable is we're actually going to start our album-by-album series, going song-by-song through each album with Boy, obviously. So indirectly, thank you for that suggestion, but we did actually already have it in the books to plan. So great minds think alike. At JK Claus says, love the podcast. Thank you. Going to Ireland soon for 20th anniversary. Congratulations. Any U2 sites that are don't miss or skip? And I think there was another episode. This is where we need our U2 fan who's a digital archivist. Yeah, who's
this was back in
index.
November.
Yeah, I don't know if you have an episode number, but if you look through goodstuff.fm/ATU2, you can quickly sort of scroll through all the episodes. And I think back, where would that be? You're thinking November? That's
it would have been the first 2 weeks of November because we went the third week of November.
Yeah, so maybe the episode called And Then I Whacked Noel Gallagher, maybe.
I think that's the one.
That might be it, yeah.
I'll put it in the show notes so if somebody can find it. That's episode number 17. But around that time, anyways, I think we went through a bunch of sort of suggestions for any U2 fan visiting Ireland. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, and in early – well, and so we on the website, we have the Dublin Guide, which has been there for, you know, 10, 15 years now, I think, and it's at u2.com/Dublin, and that's sort of a static document with, you know, a map and all the – you know, all the sites to see. And then in early November, we published, I believe, at least one, if not two, sort of new, fresher versions of like a Dublin guide or an Ireland guide for people that were traveling to see the shows in Dublin and Belfast last November. So there should be two articles in our news archives from last November as well.
Yeah, I did the Google site search for at U2, searching for Dublin, which I thought would be turn up, you know, and it does turn up hundreds of articles, so it isn't all that helpful, but the Dublin guides are at the top. So I've got those in the show notes as well as we speak. So
excellent.
Folks will be able to find those along. I hear somebody typing. I don't know.
Sorry.
No, you're allowed to type. I just wasn't sure if it was like urgent for what we were about to discuss.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just thought of.
At Bruno Caffey asks, and I think Tasula might have a response. Bono loves to sing for good causes. Not every performance is great. Which charity performance do you consider his worst? For this person, it's Mensch with German singer at Gronemeyer in Rostock 07. Did Bono rehearse at all for it? I actually forgot to go watch this. I was going to check it out, but
it's not really good. No.
We'll put the link in the show notes to it. But yeah, Tasula, did you have a comment?
I just thought of the fact that Bono participated in the absolute sacrilege remakes of Do They Know It's Christmas. Even though I wouldn't want anybody else doing his part, just the fact that those exist turns my stomach. And he's on all of them. You know, there's three now. So,
yeah. So that'll be the worst for you, I guess.
Yes.
How about you, Sherry?
Without a doubt, it's got to be New Day.
New Day.
With Wyclef Jean. That was done around the time of the NetAid era.
1998, 99, somewhere in there.
Yeah,
awful.
And so, you know, watching NetAid on VH1 at Giant Stadium with like 5,000 people taking up the whole stadium, it was painful to watch. Just as much as it was painful to listen to.
I actually remember listening to that song a bunch and liking Bono's part of it, but maybe I don't know. Maybe time hasn't been so kind.
All right, turn in your at you two staff card right now.
There goes another bad.
I guess nobody will hear this podcast. Burning it down as I leave. You have to wait until after the person's finished their duties before you fire them.
Right.
Oh, really? Okay.
With how many times you've fired people, you'd think you'd know.
Well, yeah. And yeah, you can, judging from my success in firing Sherry over 100 times.
Some sort of course you need to take.
You can tell I'm not very good at it.
No amount of antibiotics will get rid of me, Matt.
All right. So, at Obadduan, I don't know how you say that one. So how important is it for you two to make a splash with their new album to have a chart-climbing single? I haven't heard that they have a new album coming, but...
Somebody's working their ass off on it. That's all I know.
Yeah. Adam seems to be working, at least. I don't know if anybody else is
Adam
working.
And Edge. We've seen Edge's computer in a few of those shots, you know?
Yeah, he had Logic running, or GarageBand, maybe. I can't remember.
GarageBand. Yeah.
So it wasn't Facebook, at least, so... I think
it's important to you too that they make a splash and have a chart climbing single, but I don't know that it's important to the world because diehards will still buy whatever they put out and casual fans will still go see them live no matter what they're singing. So
yeah, so I'm similar. It kind of feels like they as much as they aspire to be, you know, part of the mainstream conversation and, you know, whatever, they are definitely kind of have reached that part of their career where it doesn't matter a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. They're short of, I guess, releasing something really awful, which even then I think would still sell enough to make it worthwhile for them to have done.
Right. They're going to break even.
Yeah. So I don't know, Matt, how about you? What do you think?
Tasula crystallized my thoughts eloquently.
All right. Sherry, anything to add?
What I find interesting is all the media that's been circulating about this, the word relevance hasn't really been used. Whereas when Songs of Innocence was starting the slow promotional process for years, it was all about being relevant. I'm wondering if they've accepted their lot in life and just want to put something out and let people take it for what it is instead of trying to force it down in many different ways, both in distribution, but also in trying to knock people over the head with what it's all about. I think this one, they're hopefully just going to send it out and let people experience it on their own and come up with their own ideas and conclusions on it. They've been super, you know, vocal about it, but yet they've been super secretive at the same time. So I think that whatever their plan is, knowing where their contract is, I think they'd like to go out with a big bang.
Yeah. Clayton's Kitty in the chat room, which I'm guessing is a Adam Clayton fan, maybe mentioned they shouldn't want to be mainstream. The mainstream is awful these days, which yeah, I agree. And I think that's like we said, their legacy is kind of established at this point, and I think just putting out music for their sake and their fans.
And didn't Bono say on national TV that U2's job is to F up the mainstream anyway?
Oh, that was a younger Bono. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on to at Steve Steza Daza.
You always have trouble with that name.
Is there a pronunciation guide for that one?
No, but I'm going to ask him or her to just continually send in questions.
Okay. Steza Daza. _ does it. Talk of having some same staging for the Experience Tour. Where will the Innocent songs fit in, if at all? Which we've talked a bit about a couple episodes back, I want to say, in terms of sort of how we think and envision some of the new stuff fitting in, or the last album fitting in with the new stuff. Sherry, do you have some thoughts there?
Yeah, I think it's going to be determined by which audience is going to be getting the next legs of the tour. Adam, in the recent goldderby.com interview, said that every time that they go out on tour, they pick 7 or 8 new songs to incorporate into the set list. Now, granted, on 360, that kind of got whittled down to 2 or 3. But if they're coming out gangbusters with the new album, I don't see how they're not going to try to put 7 to 8 new songs into the set, which means that others will have to either go by the wayside, or they'll do a 4-hour concert like Bruce Springsteen, which I don't think will happen. Yeah. So I think very few of the Songs of Innocence songs will remain, maybe 1 or 2 at most. And then they'll see how the audience takes to it and then shift it around. By the 10th show in on the tour, we'll have a pretty good idea where the set list will end up.
Matt, I see in the document you wrote super intelligent comment coming soon. I wasn't sure if you were commenting on what Sherry was saying or you meant you have. So, I was feeling for Sherry. To
I
try
love
and,
that vote of confidence from the boss man.
For those who don't know, we have a Google Doc that has the has the list of all these questions, and so we leave comments for each other as we're talking, for so that we know we don't talk over each other and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I just put a note in there that I have a super intelligent comment.
So it wasn't a comment on Sherry,
and that was it. Let's move on.
Okay, Matt, you're
no,
go ahead.
No, so related to all this, right? Last week, was it last week or 2 weeks, whatever it was, there was the Edge interview in Billboard that came out. And I think it was the very same day that, was it U2 Achtung or U2 France? One of the French sites had this really brief Q&A, like, 3 or 4 quick questions with Willie Williams that I assume they did at that live event for the Paris DVD, back when. And so you have Edge saying, we're busting our arses and hoping to get it done this year. That's still, the goal. That's still the plan, blah, blah, blah. And then you have Willie saying, oh, yeah, we've got a plan. The tour is all set. We're going to be on the road. The stage is going to be the same, blah, 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 blah. And I read those two things and I'm like, wait a second. This sounds so much like the Pop and the Pop Mart situation where they had a tour before they had an album, and I'm like thinking, this, are we going to get another one of those situations again where they've already booked tour dates and then the album isn't really done and all those sorts? So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there that I think we should keep an eye on things that way.
But they're wily like that. They're trying to throw us off their scent.
Yeah, they could be. I don't know.
Because Willie did say, if I tell you more, I'll have to kill you or eliminate you. So...
Yeah, we'll see. It'll be it's fun. I hope that there is like a little bit of fun they're having with it, especially with social media being what it is. I often think they don't have enough time or want to bother with all that kind of fun, but we'll see. Adam definitely has seemed to be having a little more fun with that. So, okay, moving on. At Ryan Del Garno asked, for some reason on every U2 album, there's a song I really don't like. Does everyone else get this, or is it just me? I think... there's at least, for me anyways, I can say that there's definitely songs I don't listen to as much. I know some of us in the podcast crew here definitely hate some songs. I don't have the soundboard to remind us all of that. But Matt, maybe just for...
I don't know what you're talking about.
For interest sake, do you have any songs that you're not a huge fan of?
Well, I mean, my feelings toward Sleep Like a Baby Tonight are legendary at this point, thanks to you, Chris.
And which one is For the Loss?
I was trying to figure that out myself. Free...
That's For the Loss. Sleep Like a Baby Tonight, For the Loss. Oh. For the Win?
Oh, gotcha. God. For the Loss. Oh, that's clever.
FTL, gotcha. For the Loss.
Okay.
No, I don't know that I don't know that. I mean, there's only a couple U2 songs that I really dislike, so I wouldn't say that there's one on every album. I mean, there's, but I think I agree with you, Chris. I'm the same way. There's, you know, every album has songs that I want to hear less than others, but
yeah, I just think
that's normal.
A good way to phrase this maybe is like, is there a song that you would actually actively, like, you're sitting and listening and you would actively get up or, you know, pull your phone in your pocket or wherever your music's playing from to skip a song by you two. So Tazula, you have
on every album?
Yeah.
Not every. I can't say that about War or Unforgettable Fire or even Joshua Tree. But yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you going to come clean on
For me, on the recent album, it's California, which I know will hurt people, but I never listened to that song. The only exception was when I was actually in Santa Barbara and I thought I have to listen to it because it starts with Santa Barbara. And then I turned it off like halfway through because I was over it already. but yeah, I mean, there is like, you know, A Man and a Woman from whatchamacallit, whatever that album was back in 2004. Yeah, exactly. Like, so yes, I will fast forward that one because it's so cheesy and it gives me a Vegas lounge vibe when I'm in the middle of a really good rock album.
Did you say fast forward? Is that what is that?
for the millennials out there, back when we had cassettes, you would have to push these buttons.
It was a commitment to skip a song.
Yeah, there was a commitment. It was an actual
work. Yes.
And I, like I said, sarcastically in our notes, I have the opposite problem with pop in that I only like one song, which is Gone. I love Gone. But yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a good song to like. If you not even Great please, song. You don't.
Ugh, not my.
Let's save it for the pop discussion favorite. That you won't
yeah.
be on.
Yeah, I won't be attending that. I don't think. But yes.
How about you, Sherry? Any?
Let's see here. Unforgettable Fire. I fast forward through Elvis Presley in America. Joshua Tree. I will fast forward through. In God's Country.
Wow.
That's painful.
Wow.
Who does that?
I know, right?
Now you get fired.
We're not going to have any staff.
No. The reason for that is because I watched the Joshua Tree special that was on MTV so many times that I just wanted to get through In God's Country to get to the next section. And then that just carried over with the CD.
Right.
That reminds me of our field trip. So it will never tarnish in my brain. Such a happy memory.
Even with Zooropa, I will fast forward through Daddy's Gonna Pay for Your Crashed Car.
What? That's another one I love.
Stop it before.
Well, that's because my dad was nearly killed by a drunk driver, so I really don't want
to. Oh, jeez, you know. Way to bring it down, Cher.
Yeah, but it just goes to show you that it's not necessarily because you dislike a song. Like,
that's fair.
Like, yeah. I will skip Volcano, but...
Oh, my God.
But
we're not going to be friends anymore.
This but is all- for others, there are more specific personal reasons why I do it.
Next, you're going to say you can't stand Where the Streets Have No Name or something.
Oh, my gosh, that's it.
Bring it out. I mean,
Brian Eno did have a point. No.
Why don't you skip New Year's Day on War? Why don't you just do that?
New Year's actually, Day, I skip live, actually, but just to throw that one out there.
This is this is
gosh. Who are you people? Right?
This is hilarious.
We like being smack dab little contradiction, as Bono says.
This was a really good question because it's not like the same answers we gave for our what live song would you throw out the window if, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's totally different.
I don't know if you're paying attention to the chat room, but I'm writing a new job. I'm writing a job description right now in the chat room. So.
I hope you are. I'm not, but I want to know what you're asking for.
Maybe we should just skip the album discussion and just have some therapy here amongst ourselves.
Great idea.
Group hug around Sleep
there
Like a Baby.
Are there therapists in the fan community that would like to come on as a guest?
Help us work out.
Just through some therapy, yeah.
All right. The final question for this episode is from Not Mason Merritt is which boy track do you most want to get revived in a live setting? And theirs is Twilight. Tasulo, why don't you start us off?
I love stories for boys. And I think it would be hilarious to see them do it at this age.
Yeah.
That would be funny, wouldn't it? Yeah, well, I could
see
that.
That'd be fun. And it's a fun song. I mean, it's an upbeat. I think it would be good live. Now.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Anybody else? Anything come to mind, Matt? Do you have a particular choice?
I don't know. I guess we'll talk about our favorite songs when we get to that album section. Yeah. They've played so many of them actually over the last few tours.
They right? have. They, yeah.
Right? You know, they played The Ocean. They played Uncut Dub Into the Heart. They played. They started doing Electrico again a few tours ago. I guess I would probably say Twilight too. That's one of my favorite songs. So I'll go with that one.
Yeah, I would agree too. Just in terms of how they would pull it off live, you know, in thematically as well as just musically, I guess, just to see.
Oh, that would be good. It would fit.
Yeah,
that's true.
Sherry, anything jump out for you?
I'm going with Shadows and Tall Trees.
Interesting.
I'm sorry.
We're all just thinking about Shadows and Tall Trees.
Yeah, trying to imagine what it would sound like live.
I just thought, well, that I like that song. I'm not discrediting that at all, but I just think it would be boring live.
I had in my notes, in which I'll spoil the discussion later, I guess, but there's the bridge building in that song that sounds very reminiscent of modern U2 sounds, but everything else is kind of, I have a hard time picturing how they do it. But I guess that's what could also be really interesting just to see again how they could pull it off if they...
The visuals would be awesome. I would like to see what Willie came up with for that, mm-hmm. You know, if they did screen stuff.
Yeah, screen time.
Screen time.
All right. Well, thanks, folks, for sending in questions. Those are some awesome ones, and you can participate in that if you would like to. On Twitter, you just send a tweet, as they say, with hashtag AskAtU2, and that'll get captured in from Twitter, and we'll grab it and use it in future episodes. It can be a question, a comment about the podcast, something that you disagree with or something that you really agree with, and a comment for Matt about Sleep Like a Baby. Any number of things you can send in, and we'll use it in future show for discussion. So thanks to the folks who sent it in. If you have sent in other questions, there's a bunch. I know we're a bit of a backlog because we haven't recorded in a while. Those are still there. We'll hopefully get to them in future episodes and keep sending those in. We love it. All right. For the roundtable, as we sort of teased out at the beginning and mentioned, I think, in the last episode, is we're going to start doing a bit of a album by album discussion over the next little while. Pending, I guess, something like a new album dropping in the middle, then we might have to disrupt and talk about
that. Feel free to mess with our plans, you two. Yeah. Go ahead. Make our day.
Ideally, we won't, you know, if we keep on our every bi-weekly kind of episode release, we won't have to wait that long for the new album in a perfect world. But who knows? That's a discussion for another podcast. But yeah, we'll be going by album, song by song through U2's discography, Boy to Song of Songs of Innocence. So this episode is, of course, Boy. So we could save the song by song kind of discussion for after, but I'm curious just like a bit of the history about U2 at the time. Obviously, this is their first album, et cetera. But someone, I don't know who would want to start us off there. Matt, you've written a book about U2, I heard.
So maybe that'd be a good place.
He might
start.
Be a good person to start with for some resource information.
I did, didn't I? I remember that. That was fun. Yeah, it was so. And you know, your questions to kind of sort of guide things are I guess a good jumping off point. It was so it was released on October 20th, 1980, and they started recording it. I mean, they recorded it in like 3 months. 4 months, maybe. I think they started in June, I want to say. And they had signed with Island Records earlier in the year in March. I think it was, you know, whatever the exact date was, I don't remember. But they signed with Island Records. They did the first single with Island, which was 11 O'Clock TikTok. And that was with Martin Hannett, who was Joy Division's producer. And he was supposed to produce Boy as well. But then he stepped away because the lead singer, Ian Curtis, committed suicide, so Martin Hannett was out. And I don't recall, I was trying to figure out, and you guys will, I hope, be able to help. I don't recall ever reading any story about how or where they found Steve Lillywhite.
It's in YouTube IU2.
Is it? What do you recall the story off the top of your head?
Let's see here. I'm looking in the paperback book, page 128.
I feel like he told me when I interviewed him, didn't he?
I don't recall.
I feel like. Yeah.
This is one of the things.
I got to look at my own interview.
Well, Sherry actually fired me today because as I was researching for this episode, I realized that in the past 5 or 10 years on the website, we have done a 25-year history of – we did a special feature on war when it was 25 years old. We did another special feature on war when it was 30 years old. We did a special feature on October when it was 30 years old, and we never did anything about boy. So clearly I did not have myself my planning and organization together.
So according to Edge, this is starting now. Once again, I'm in the paperback version of YouTube IU2 on page 127. He says, Martin canceled the last minute. I think he was completely devastated, and recording with U2 was just something he wasn't up to at the moment. Steve Lillywhite's name came up. He had just done Susie and the Banshees, XTC, great groups we really admired, and we had a chance to road test the relationship with Steve with our second single, which was A Day Without Me.
Right.
And then Bono said Steve was such a breath of fresh air. He came in like a children's television presenter. Okay, everybody, take out a box of cornflakes and get an old container of orange juice and chop the top off it. If you glue them back together, you can make a phone.
Oh, my gosh.
I love some of these quotes in this book.
So that makes sense. So it was they were familiar with him because he had worked with artists that they were listening to at the time. So, and the reason that I sort of mentioned all this stuff about the producers is because I listened to Boy a couple times during the day today in anticipation of our conversation, and I just think that, you know, I know not everybody loves Steve Lillywhite, but I just think he did a fantastic job on this album. I think it's just beautifully produced. And when you're the producer of a band's first album, like a, you know, they had no idea what they were doing in the studio. They didn't have a sound. They, you know, the producer of your first album really, really sort of sets your identity right out of the gate. And I just think he was just a really, you know, inspired choice. And I was listening to the album today, I'm like, you know, just what a great, you know, combination of him working with them and creating this sound and all that sort of stuff. So.
And the fascinating thing is that Larry didn't think that Steve was up for the job.
Yes, I recall that. I recall hearing that as well.
He said, I was 18 when we recorded Boy and wasn't confident at all about my playing. I was hampered by my inexperience, my inability to loosen up. I had good ideas. I just couldn't play them like everyone else. It was Steve's idea to record my drums under the studio stairwell. It felt strange at first. We were just getting used to recording together, and the next thing, I'm under the stairs. And then there was overdubbing, and I was asking, what the hell's an overdub? And then Steve would patiently explain, that's when you put, that's when you play on top of something you've already recorded. I had no idea how these things worked. I was out of my depth. Steve was a great producer, and he had his tricks, and he knew how to use them. The big drum sound, that was his.
There you go. Interesting. And actually, just by way of mentioning Steve Lillywhite, he's a great follow on Twitter, at Silly White, and touring the world. And he happens to be in Jakarta right now. Matt and I both discovered this today, or at least that's where his Twitter account says he is. And curious if he's doing music there or what's going on. But anyways, he's entertaining and happily tweets back to fans and stuff like that. So,
he's always been happy. He's always been happy to talk with us, and Tesola interviewed him, and I mean we've interviewed him a few different times for the site. So,
yeah,
nice,
very accessible,
yeah,
and very patient.
He's going to produce our first album too.
Yeah,
we should get him to produce the podcast.
Right, be improved. Yeah, he'd walk out
after I fire all of you. Yes.
Matt, there's some other stuff. I know you have some of the stuff in the notes, and so just kind of like following through some of that, and something of very keen interest to me as a guitar player, and sort of drew me to you two and figuring out how to do this crazy echo reverb sound that I, for me, was like, you know, Streets Have a Name and Actung stuff. But obviously started way back when. How he got the echo unit thing, what's the story there?
Yeah, well, because I was going through my book today just to see what I had.
Oh, you wrote a book?
Yeah, I did write a book. Did I not mention that? It's U2 A Diary. You can find it on Amazon.
What's the ISBN number?
I was just gonna say I don't remember.
We'll put the links in the show. Yeah,
yeah. Go ahead and do that. I'll get a call from like the publisher, Matt. There was a sudden spike in sales. You sold four copies this week instead of one.
I have a question from Diary fans out there. Amazon.com and Amazon Canada both had the first edition. Amazon UK says it's the second edition. Is there a discrepancy, or maybe that's just your site that needs to get updated?
No. Sorry. That's true. The second edition was only published in the UK.
Oh. Okay.
Matt's because huge over there, like David Hasselhoff in Germany.
Oh,
I have a vision of Matt running down the beach now, but I won't share that with you. Yeah.
No, get that vision out of your mind.
That's the first thing I do, though. I have to confess, I go all over the world now for my day job, and every time I'm in a music store or a bookstore in another country, I go see if they have his book.
Oh, get out of here. Then they never do, right?
They did in England. They did in England.
Nice.
Yeah. It's because you're so big over there.
It's huge.
So much in Iceland, not so much in Japan. But
there was a Croatian version, by the way, of which I have five copies on my shelf right over here. So
cool. All right. Well, if anybody is listening from Croatia and wants a copy, we'll figure out a way to get you a signed copy maybe of somehow. I don't imagine you have.
How did we get sidetracked on
this? Huge use for it. Anyways.
Anyway, so one of the things that I discovered was that as they were working on the new songs for the Boy album, Bono came to Edge and he said, and they were working on A Day Without Me, and that's when Bono said, "Look, I have this sound in my head where it's sort of there's a repeat or an echo going on," and they just had this conversation, and so that's what prompted Edge to go buy the what's it called, the Memory Man Echo Unit or whatever, and you know, from that moment on, U2's sound has forever been changed, and so that's in terms of importance of, this album and maybe one particular song, that's pretty huge.
Yeah. It's crazy to think of like just the random happenstance kind of stuff that they stumbled into in the early days that, went on to clearly define them as a band that, he could have just discarded, tried it once, couldn't figure out how to get the echo to work right, tossed it aside. And then, Joshua Tree as an album probably wouldn't exist.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And many other songs, in the form that they came out anyways. So, very cool. And other recordings, any other recording stories or stories of that, getting the album made that anybody has?
They talk, I'm sure they talk in, Sherry, if you have U2 by U2 open, I'm sure they talk about the upside down bike that, where they were, you can hear it during I Will Follow and the bottles that they used. And there's just all these different clicking sounds and other strange sound effects throughout the album, and I think that upside down bike story is like the one that Lily White and the band has talked about pretty regularly.
Yeah, the sound effects on the ocean, there's like the bubbles and there's some sort of clicking noise as well that I was listening to. I had it really loud when I was listening to it this afternoon, and I thought something was wrong with my hard drive. Like it was that kind of like rhythm, and I was like panicking, like. And I remembered that actually I have a solid state drive, so it's actually nothing spinning, but it was that exact kind of whatever rhythm that kind of freaked me out for a while. But it's definitely something that was, they did a lot in the earlier albums, but haven't done a lot of, sort of like that extra effecty kind of stuff, sound effects, Foley work, as it were, on albums that I recall. I'm sure there is examples of it in later work, but they're a bit more experimental that way in the first early days, that's for sure. How about naming the album? Where, like, settling on Boy and where that came from and how they figured the name of their first album out?
Well, that was something Bono has said several times that he had the image of what he wanted the album cover to look like and the name of the album 2 years before they even recorded the album. He wanted it to be innocent. He wanted it to be the introduction of the band. And based on that, that dictated the album artwork and mostly everything about the actual recording of it. For fans who happen to have Stealing Hearts at a Traveling Show, the graphic design of U2 by 451 Creative, there is some great information in that book about the Boy album cover.
That's a great book for
information
about
all the
now,
albums.
I think it's Steve Averill. Wrote here, says, when it was released in 1980, the Boy album sleeve was exceptional. After the messy vibrancy of punk graphics with its cacophony of color and overtly expressive use of type, its cool silver tones and image of vulnerability suggested delicacy and openness. In some ways, it echoed the neoclassicism of Peter Saville's work for Joy Division, but whereas his imagery drew on classical references in a fairly direct way, with Boy, this was apparent mainly through the colors and the symmetry of the Boy's pose. Although suggestive in compositional terms of classical art, the use of a young child looking directly at the viewer lent it emotional impact. If one of the themes of the music and sleeve was vulnerability and inexperience, the design was assured for the debut album of a young band, not least because the band's name was scarcely visible. Averill actually argued against including U2 on the cover at all, and in the end it was placed just visibly against the Boy's hair. And in the U.S. the album cover was highly controversial because of the pedophilia feeling about having a child without clothing and so on, and that's why for the U.S. album for Boy, it's got the four band members kind of, you know, blurry like that. And what I find interesting is the juxtaposition of Boy and Songs of Innocence, and how Songs of Innocence kind of had a similar a freak out from a particular group of people about a pedophilia type of thing, where you've got a topless boy, you know, and a topless man hugging the boy. For those who didn't know that that was Larry's eldest son, and of course Larry hugging his eldest son. But the if you look at Boy, or rather if you compare Boy and Songs of Innocence, they can almost be bookends, and is a wonderful way to spend a couple hours listening to them both side by side.
Yeah, that's what actually, that's where my brain went squirrely, is because I, in my iTunes albums listing, it has the North American cover, and I was thinking about the artwork as the question that we were going to talk about, and then I was like, what, wait, where, my brain stops. So the reception of the album and when it came out, Matt, you had a couple of stats sort of from reviews from the time anyways when it was released and stuff like that. And
yeah, we have a couple of the reviews in our news archives on At U2. If you go to the news section and then choose 1980 and just click the button, Hot Press gave it 11 stars out of 12. The Irish Times gave it a really good review. NME gave it a really good review. I'm sure there are others. You know, of course, it's hard to track down stuff that's, you know, that old at this point. But yeah, it was very well received, and I think justifiably so. I think, you know, I've seen, you know, more recently over the years, you know, when like Rolling Stone or Billboard or somebody, you know, VH1 or whatever, they'll do the, you know, these lists of the, you know, the greatest debut albums of all time. You know, Boy always is somewhere on the list, you know, whether compared to others, who knows, but it's, yeah, I think it deserves all those accolades. I think it's, you know, for, the thing that strikes me is that they were so freaking young, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when Boy it was released, like, Larry was just about to turn 19. I mean, he's as old as my son is right now. My son is 18. And it just, it's mind-boggling that this group of 18 and 19-year-olds put this album out, and it's as great as it is. I just, it's, I don't know. I'm a big fan.
No.
Can you tell?
That's what we won't. I think we'll just get into the song discussion because, like you said, we got to keep moving. But that idea of, and something we'll try and do with each album as we talk about it, is a bit of just like putting yourself in the head of a person listening to it for the first time at that time when it came out. I was 4 years old or so, and I don't recall my parents playing it for me to put me to sleep or anything. And so in that sense, but yeah, the songs, especially the way that they carry through today, just in, obviously we're a bit biased as U2 fans, but feel a lot of them feel as relevant. Some of them feel a little dated in their production style, but yeah. Anyways, let's get into the songs, shall we? So we'll go track by track and just kind of as much or as little as we want to discuss, and I'll let you guys sort of jump in as you want to. And starting with, of course, I Will Follow, which is a song that I think most U2 fans have heard. but yeah, I don't know who wants to start us off. Matt, why don't you jump in?
Great opening song for your first album. Great way to introduce your band to the world. And I mean, we talked about some of the sound effects and the production on it already. And, you know, obviously it has a lot of personal meaning for, you know, with the lyrics with Bono. It's, you know, it's one of those. I kind of feel like, you know, personally, I kind of take it for granted because I've heard it live so many times now, and they play it every tour and all. But it, you know, again, when I was listening to the album today a couple times, it's really a great song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else comments on I Will Follow?
I miss Bono being able to play the guitar on it.
Oh,
good point.
Yeah, because that's one where I thought he actually did a good job.
Yeah, where he actually added something, and it wasn't kind of just like he didn't know what to do with his hands, so he had a guitar kind of feeling. Yeah, Twilight is the track two on the album, and
now, something every fan should have in their collection is the Into the Heart book, the stories behind every U2 song. And in it, it talks about how Twilight was a song that was a curious track about how older men would sometimes follow younger men and invite them to, you know, do things that they might not have felt comfortable with doing. And so there's that type of an overtone. Stokes writes, "No one in Ireland thought of the song as dealing with homosexuality or the confusion of sexual identity that so many adolescents feel to one degree or another. Yet it's there in the lyrics once you come at them from a certain angle." And, you know, for them to start writing such heavy lyrics as track two on your debut album, it certainly tells you that this is a band who has something to say.
Yeah, not your ordinary band.
Yeah, all right. Moving on to Ankat. How do you say it again?
Ankat Dove.
Ankat Dove, Into the Heart. Matt, why?
One of my all-time favorite U2. I mean, it's technically two different songs, but, you know, they segue into each other, so we're just going to treat it as one song. One of my all-time favorites in U2's entire history. And the thing that, see, what I love about these two together is, like, the rest of this album, you can tell, you know, that they're kids and that they're 18 and 19, because, like, almost every song on the album, it sounds like they're in a hurry to get finished. Right? Like, they rush through I Will Follow, Twilight they rush through, Out of Control, Stories, right? Like, most of these songs, it's like, you know, hurry, 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 let's get through the song. But then Ankat Dove and Into the Heart is just this slow and meandering and it's just so different for me, at least, from everything else on the album. And I just love the little interlude right in the middle, from about the 4 minute to the 5 or 6 minute mark, where the songs sort of segue in together. And I just think it's beautiful. Like I said, they're so young, and for them to be able to write this combination of songs together when everything else almost on the album is just this rush of energy, it just blows my mind. These two together, I love these two songs.
And is there the story behind, you know, having it separately originally, like on the tape and album version or whatever, listed two tracks, and then now together? Is there any? Do we know any details about why and how that sort of transitioned, or?
I don't know if they've ever talked about that. It's not anything I remember.
Stokes wrote the segue from Uncut Dub into the Heart had more to do with exogenesis mm-hmm. of the performance than with the theme. The sequence worked on stage, and therefore it made sense to do it that way on the record.
Oh, interesting.
When Bono would lay down on Elevation and put on women's lipstick during those songs. That was kind of amazing.
Well, this is a song that Bono has said was about a little affair that he had after he and Ali had broken up very, very briefly, that he had a fling with another woman.
He was like 15 or something?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
oh my God.
He was so guilt-filled that he had done that, especially seeing as he had reconciled with Ali, that the symbolism of the black cat going after a bird and doing what cats do with birds, that it's a song mourning the loss of an innocence, and the putting the two songs together, it's like half of it is the act of the betrayal, and then the other part of it is the forgiveness of what you had just done.
Yeah, which again cuts to like what Matt was saying, just like how does an 18-year-old you know, nothing against Matt's son or whatever. You look at an 18-year-old or 19-year-old, you're like, where is that in you or whatever? Like,
right,
how are you coming out with this as a band, and then lyrically and thematically and stuff like that? And having it like not that 18-year-olds are dumb or don't have creative thoughts, obviously, but like, you know, often it's kind of more on the naive and innocent side, but this kind of, to have it all flesh out and come through as it does on the album, is just a testament to what obviously the band was going to be. Next one up is Out of Control. Which for me was actually Boy as an album is an album I hadn't listened to a lot of, but hearing Out of Control live when they brought it back, a couple tours ago, and hearing it performed, and it kind of like reignited my interest in going back to the archives of U2, as it were. But this song to me is just like, even when I put it on now from the Boy album, not the live version necessarily, but like from the Boy album, it just feels like such a, like the most, to me, it's my favorite song on the album, I think, and the most relevant song today, even still. And again, kind of like what you were saying with I Will Follow, is just like such a great way. And that in the original release anyways would have been the end of side one, and kind of like wasn't a, you know, we're going out quietly kind of song, obviously, to choose as your end of side one. And back when albums had sides, and yeah, still is just like such a fun kick butt song in my opinion.
Yeah,
so
I agree. Great staying power. And I agree with you. When they brought it back, I think it was the Elevation tour, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think that was the first time I saw it live. And a couple friends of ours, Scott and Answer Guy, told me that they'd never seen me like so happy as when I first heard Out of Control live. So, yeah.
Wait until you hear Sleep Like a Baby live. That is going to...
Yeah, I can wait. Trust me.
All right. I don't mean to cut anybody off, so feel free to jump in if there's other things you would like to add, but we'll keep moving. Stories for Boys is the next song on the album.
Yeah, so once again, Stokes writes in the book that the band's manager, Paul McGinnis, was always convinced that the song Stories for Boys was a song about masturbation.
Oh,
Gaze, too, identified with it, reading a homoerotic slant into the lines.
And the podcast is now PG-13.
There you go. He also quotes Bono saying, "This was it. For the gays in our audience, this was definitely a love song to a man. I thought of Stories for Boys as just simple escapism, and it's not really. We were very conscious on one level, but there was a whole subconscious thing going on, too. There really is a sense in which the songs write themselves."
I had never read it that way, but now looking at the lyrics, you can kind of, I guess, you could see that in them. Next up is The Ocean. How about Tasula? We haven't heard from you in a while.
I love The Ocean because it goes back to literature, which a lot. This was the first actual song that they had released that went directly to a piece of literature. Of course, the picture of Dorian Gray. Picture in gray, Dorian Gray, just me by the sea. Dorian Gray is one of Larry Mullen's nicknames internally, apparently, because he, you know, doesn't seem to age much, or at least he didn't for many years. And it's just a quiet, mature kind of, to me, it sounds like young men trying to be mature. Like if I were sitting in a room with a bunch of teenage boys right now and they were trying to write something really profound and they borrowed, like, let's borrow something from literature. That's how I envision this panning out. I have no idea if that's actually what happened, but I think it's sweet and I've always liked the song and I'm glad it's still there.
Very cool. Okay, next up is The Day Without Me.
This one, yeah. So this one I love, and this is where I think they actually start developing a little more sophistication, because it's a very upbeat song melodically, but it's a very depressing song lyric-wise, because it's actually about a suicide. And you would never guess that from listening to it and bouncing along with it. But very profound and very simple. Simple without being simplistic.
Right. One of my favorites, too. Yeah, I love A Day Without Me.
It's a great song.
The recording style of it, anyways, sounded like one of the most 80s sounding songs on the album in terms of maybe just production and stuff. I don't remember specifically what it is. Yeah, that little hook in the song that kind of just sounds kind of 80s style-ish that... So, you know, a lot of, I find anyways, and again, we're biased, I keep sort of prefacing everything with that, but like, I find a lot of their music doesn't scream 80s music to me compared to
all.
A lot of other 80s stuff, but so when it does, it kind of just, I guess, maybe sticks out more in my mind, and that's what that particular song does. But next up is Another Time, Another Place.
Club release, we could talk about that. The vinyl last year. Anyone else get the vinyl in the mail? Am I the only one getting mail from you too? is this what's happening? Is my doorstep just somehow a receptacle for all these magical treats? And no one knows what the hell I'm talking about.
Of course we know what you're talking about.
Well, you're all just dead silent.
Like, I was just waiting for you to go on, that's all.
Final, right? Like, I am mentioning... Well, I think that, first of all, I think that was an odd thing for them to pick. To just commemorate this somewhat forgettable song. Like, why that one? Of all the songs they could have picked from their first album, why that one?
Yeah. Because the songs were done at another time and at another place. I think it was just literal.
I think the title, yeah.
That's grown worthy. You're probably right.
I don't feel too strongly one way or another about Another Time, Another Place. I think isn't that the song that has Bono like doing Bongolese at the end of the song, and we've never figured out what the lyrics are, and so that's tends to be what I think of the most with that song is these mysterious lyrics at the end of the song.
Nonsense. I swear that it's
such nonsense. He was just trying to do like a White Album thing and it went awry. That's my theory.
Well, the Stokes's take on it is that Another Time, Another Place was slang for sex in Dublin as a teenager. It's about finding a place you can be with your girlfriend, which was a real problem at the time.
Not
page
everything.
19.
According to Niall Stokes, everything was about that.
It's starting to be a little Freudian on this podcast.
I think it is too. So let's move on to other sources.
Niall was maybe working through some issues.
And YouTube by YouTube.
I think he was. Yeah, I think he was, Chris.
Niall was frustrated when he wrote the book.
I think he was.
Okay. You should have him on the next podcast. Answer yourself.
Right? The Electrico. There's nothing going on there, right? It's all just...
It's amazing. Best live song.
I know, right?
I'm telling you, anytime they start those first few chords that Edge hammers out, I am jumping up and down. I mean, I love this song live. I love it so much. I prefer it to Out of Control and I Will Follow. You know, on the nights that they alternate one or the other, I would much prefer this.
It's a song about anger and injustice more than anything else.
Why I like it. Yeah. But it lights up the stage. I mean, does anybody disagree with me?
No, I'm totally with you. It's awesome. It's fantastic live. And
what was interesting was, they recorded this in 1980, right? That apparently one of the muses with this song was the character Alex in A Clockwork Orange. Which, if you fast forward to, 1989, when Bono and Edge wrote the music for A Clockwork Orange 2004, you know, that type of throwback goes all the way back to the beginning of the band's career.
Cool. Okay, so finally, the last song on the album, Shadows and Tall Trees, which we talked a bit about before, but...
This is one song, given the Innocence and Experience tour, that I'm really surprised didn't have a place in the set, simply because that the title was taken from Chapter 4 of Lord of the Flies, which is probably why Lord of the Flies was one of the books that Bono ripped up or kicked at the end of the stage during Until the End of the World, that it was something special between Lipton Village amongst themselves, where it was a gang mentality in Dublin during those early days, and you needed that pack in order to survive. So if you're telling the grander story of the band's history and you know, let's reminisce about the past type of thing, this song encapsulates so much about where the band was and is a really good closer to this album.
Yeah, and maybe just the music style or whatever, like we talked about earlier, was harder to figure out a way to incorporate or something. I don't know. Because, yeah, reading the lyrics through, it definitely seems like something that would fit in the sort of history section of the show. But... last time they performed it live, according to U2.com, anyways, is July
27th,
1980.
Yep.
Yeah, this was the first one. Like, it's funny that we're talking about it, like, visually being represented, because every time somebody brings it up or I hear it, I actually picture the handwritten lyrics to it, because that was the first time I'd ever seen Bono's handwritten lyrics.
Interesting.
I think my second time in Ireland. It was when I was there for Slane, and we all went to what used to be the Irish Rock and Roll Museum or whatever. I mean, it's new now and different, but they used to have a different Rock and Roll Hall of Fame type thing, where they had a wax Bono, and the lyrics for this song were right next to that. And I remember just standing there in front of them for a long time, just looking at how he, you know, must have scribbled them out. So anytime anybody brings this up, that's what my brain goes to. Don't know why I just told you all that story, but felt I had to share it.
No, it's relevant. I think that's what's what we hope to do and through this series. And I don't know if anybody, if you want to have a closing comment on Boy as an album, but what we hope to do with this series is inject a little bit of, you know, personal interest story along with like the obvious history stuff that, you know, if you really wanted to find out, you probably have already with some of this stuff. But I know for me, being more of an Achtung Baby era, kind of joining the U2 fandom, a lot of the earlier history stuff isn't as familiar to me. And I don't necessarily have every single book, U2 book on my shelf. And so it's good to have.
I'll have to remedy that. Did you say you need Matt McGee's U2 a diary shipped to your house?
Make sure it's printed in Polish.
Yeah, the Croatian edition, please.
Yeah. You're just going to get all kinds of things in your, now your doorstep's going to be the receptacle.
Talk through the future albums, all the albums, I guess, as we go and inject a little bit of personal interest as well as, you know, stuff that you already know and maybe have heard before or heard our spin on it anyway. So we'll be doing, obviously, album by album chronologically. And so you can sort of look forward to and plan out your weeks of podcast listening ahead, I guess. But yeah, anybody have any sort of closing comments they want to throw in here for?
I think it's really interesting that in the off-camera interview with Sam Jones that Edge did a little while ago, Edge had expressed that he and Adam were improvising during NCADub and Into the Heart, that was the first time that they really improvised and worked off of one another. And yet Bono had said that the music had been really worked through. So when he showed up at the studio, the music might have been done for him, but that it wasn't wholly planned how the orchestration ended up on that song. So I think the band themselves should get together and get their story straight.
That goes for every interview every one of them ever did. But yeah, I agree with you.
Very true.
Sherry with her Captain Obvious comment.
Right, Captain Obvious right there, yeah. No, but that's true. That's a fair point. I think it's cool that for a debut album, I still regularly hear I Will Follow and Out of Control on the radio. Mm-hmm. Here and there. And that, I don't think every band can say that. I mean, unless you're the Beatles or unless you're, you know, the Stones or something. I don't think every band has a lot of their debut album stuff playing this many years later.
Yeah, especially combined with, like, there's the one-hit wonders who it's you only hear their debut album because then they disappear. But I think, yeah, combined, like what you're saying, that combined with the fact that they've been going this long and still going.
And they have such bigger hits. You know, these weren't big hits by our scope, but.
Yeah, definitely. Matt, any closing comments from you?
No, I think I said enough already, but I do in the show notes, Chris, I'm going to ask you to include a link to something that Rolling Stone published in 2008. This was when the Boy reissue came out for the repackaging, the whole nine yards. And so David Fricke posted a review of the reissue on RollingStone.com, and apparently Bono was reading this review on their website and decided to leave a comment on RollingStone.com. And it's this really long comment that Rolling Stone said, you know, look, it's way too long to post as a comment on the review, so we're going to publish it word for word as, you know, Bono's review of the Boy album. And it's really long, and it's really, really great. And so I think that, you know, that it's a really great summary of what Bono thinks of the album and what the band was going through, and you know, the good and the bad and all that sort of stuff. So it's really worth reading. So for people that missed it back then, hopefully we'll just put the link down in the show notes.
Yeah, and he's got his, I'm just pull one little pull quote from it. He's got his usual humble attitude and review of The Edge, because he says, surely this is the most influential guitarist since the great composers Jimmy Page, Pete Townsend, Neil Young. et cetera. And, but I mean, in hindsight, obviously, yes. And very true. And, but yeah, just the, it is interesting reading this through knowing that it's Bono, not just some reviewer, music reviewer or right. fan or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah. And there is a mention of sex and virginity in there, Sherry, so you weren't too far off.
I know my sources.
Let's not let this be a thread for the other albums.
Oh,
until we get to Europa.
Until we get to
Babyface.
Until we get to the fifth member being censored in.
Yeah, tongue, I was going to say. There's a little bit.
There's a lot of sex in that. I'll allow it for that one.
I can't even look at octungbaby.com because my
your filters.
Yeah, my filters will not allow me to view it.
Well, that means you're a good parent that you have those filters. I on the other hand don't have children, so I can see whatever the hell I want. It's awesome.
All right. Did we discuss that on the Eps podcast? Did that came out?
Matt? No, we did not.
Oh,
no.
Well, let's discuss it quickly here because we've gone over time enough as it is. Might as well make it worth it as well.
We're only like an hour and 15 minutes in at this point. So anybody that's still listening, for the seven people still listening.
I'm sure I'll edit out 45 minutes of it or whatever. So.
all of the Niall Stokes sex commentary.
He'll make a PG version right. and a rated R version.
No, it's actungbaby.com is a site that popped up on the internet recently.
Yeah, some guy that I know pretty well. No, it's just one of our readers came to me like a year or two ago and said, "Hey, I registered this domain ages ago, but I'm not going to do anything with it. Do you want it?" And I was like, "Yes, I want it.
Well, of course, I want it."
You know, so I don't even remember what I paid for it, but you know, we negotiated, and I bought the domain from him, and
that's where our bonuses went.
Shh. Hush you.
So. I'm still waiting for my 1999 residuals.
Niall Stokes got all our residuals, so there you go. I just have been looking for a reason and an excuse to devote some time to it, and it occurred to me that this was the 25th anniversary of Octung Baby, so I thought, what better time to do it? And so, yeah, so I just threw together the website about Octung Baby. It's not anything that I think is ever going to be updated. It's not like there's any more news about Octung Baby that's going to come out at this point.
Just you wait.
Yeah, you're right, right? Who knows? There could be more remasters and reissues. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Shoot, it wasn't just Adam.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and a million hearts started palpitating.
What I like is that there's different things that cover up Adam's business, depending on the version you got.
But oh, really?
I have a shamrock on mine.
Yes. That would be a good podcast title when we do the Octung Baby podcast. There's different things that covers up Adam's business.
That's right.
And in wrapping up our boy discussion, Fabiano mentioned the remastered album, the deluxe edition, does have a bunch of extra tracks, obviously, that weren't included. For the sake of brevity, we'll leave for another episode. Maybe we'll have the remastered edition of this episode sometime down the road, 20th anniversary.
With all of Edge's commentary, right?
Yeah, exactly. to discuss, but definitely it's out there and available.
We're in trouble for Octung Baby if that's the case. We've got...
Oh, serious.
There'll be a couple episodes maybe on that one, I think. Cool. All right. Well, thanks to Sula, Sherry, Matt for joining me in this discussion. And thanks to you folks for listening. But before we end... Don't worry. We'll get to that.
Oh.
That's for the live folks who stick around way longer than the rest of... Where can folks find you on the web, Tasula, if they need to critique your suggestion?
At Tasula on Twitter, TASSOULA.
And Sherry, how about you?
At Matt McGee.
And Matt, how about you?
I am at number one Niall Stokes fan. No, I'm at Matt McGee.
All right.
Doggone you, at you too, com Sherry.
And I'm iChris on Twitter, and you can follow the At You Two crew on Twitter at ATU2, conveniently enough, and facebook.com/ATU2com. And you can find this episode on the internet later, if you're listening much later, goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34. You'll find links to all the stuff we discussed, some of the books and the things we talked about. Obviously, if you don't have it by now, there'll be a link to iTunes, etc., to buy the album if by some reason you don't have Boy and you've listened through this long and thought now is the time to buy the album. You can do that. And definitely please subscribe to the show. If you're in iTunes, leave us a comment. Rating, review in there is great and helps get the word out about the show. And tell all your friends. And we look forward to coming up next is October. And we'll see who from At U2 staff shows up to chat.
I already have a commitment for that show.
As in you want to be on it or you're busy and you don't want to be on it?
No. Well, I think I can be on it, but I invited our old friend Answer Guy to be on tonight because I thought Boy was his favorite album, and no, he said no. October's my favorite album. Yeah. So he wants to be on next time.
All right. So there you go. If you have questions related to or thoughts about October, now you know in advance that we're going to be discussing that. Send in maybe your favorite song from the album, any particular story from the album you want to relate or send our way. Ask At U2 is the hashtag to use on Twitter, and you can send that in, and we'll use your comment and discussion in the future episodes. So I think that's it for now. Thanks for listening this long, and we'll see you again next time. Bye.